HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan, announcing show number 196, recorded live Thursday, January 21st, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks about new features in .NET 4 with Jason Olson.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Coming up on episode 200 here. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do for episode 200, but it'll be cool, or it'll be just another show. But this, in fact, is a show with Jason Olson, my good buddy from Microsoft DPE. How's it going, Jason?
It's going very well. How about yourself, Scott?
Oh, you know, I'm getting there. Can you do me a favor, please? Every time I try to explain what DPE is, I get in trouble. I went on a show called Herding Code, and I explained how I understood it, and then I got emails from people saying, well, it's not really like that, it's more like this. So do me a favor, put me and you into context at Microsoft.
So I think evangelism as a role is pretty interesting. DPE, of course, stands for Developer and Platform Evangelism, so it's entirely an evangelism organization. And actually, there's a good amount of work and type of work in common that we do with you and your team, thinking about technical evangelism here at corporate. The biggest disconnect is that here in corporate, we have technical evangelists, and then in the field, we may have developer evangelists, academic evangelists, ISV evangelists, and all sorts of field personnel around the world that'll go talk to directly to customers or directly to an ISV or directly to schools, sharing all the stuff that's coming out on Microsoft technology, really from an evangelism standpoint. Now, one thing that I've come to appreciate over my time in DPE is in the past, I've always pushed back and said, you know, DPE is not a marketing org. It's not marketing. And the more I've learned about marketing and marketing's role in the life cycle of a product and all that kind of stuff, my coworkers might kill me, but DPE is most definitely very valuable as a marketing organization.
That's what I always say that we're all trying to sell Microsoft, I guess, effectively, in the sense that we work
absolutely.
For the man and we want the man to be successful. But I always think of my team as like an education team, and we're not really pushing any particular agenda. But you guys are given. You know, your bosses want you to talk about certain things, right?
Yeah, in technical evangelism here at corporate, the extent of what they want us to talk about is really the technology we're focused on. So on the team I'm on, we're focused on Visual Studio 2010 and .NET Framework 4. So basically anything within that realm, we're allowed to talk about, even helping the product team figure out what's the messaging about this and what's valuable about this feature, or frankly, sometimes we find ourselves, what's not valuable about this? Where's the disconnect that the product team doesn't see? And doing that reverse feedback as well.
Mm-hmm. And what is the difference between the DPE people that work in Redmond and the ones that are wandering around the world?
So the ones that work in Redmond, the technical evangelists, have very close ties directly back to the product team. Almost to the extent that we're a natural extension of the product team. Like, you know, John Papa with Silverlight and now Managed Extensibility Framework and stuff. He's technically not on those teams. He's in DPE, but he might as well be on those teams. So we have very close ties both to the product teams and as well as the marketing organization to help push all our stuff through the marketing channels and push all our stuff to the people in the field who are then going to be the ones scaling all the effort to talk to customers directly in a specific geographic location.
Okay. Cool. That makes sense. That's pretty much how I thought it worked, but somehow I always explain it much less eloquently than that. But enough nonsense about job descriptions and stuff. Talk to me about .NET 4, because I know you've been doing a lot of stuff in .NET 4, and we're coming up on it's going to come out soon. Right. So what should we know? There's a pile of stuff, probably more than we can fit into one show. But what are the highlights from the point of view of you?
So what's interesting is from me in our .NET Framework Evangelism team, I tend to cover some of the lower level library and language stuff. And then my cohort, my partner in crime, Jonathan Carter, focuses more on data access, the web stack, and all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. it's amazing when you look at the entire picture of .NET Framework 4, we're talking about a really huge release. You know, one might argue that it's too big and Microsoft needs to learn to modularize better, but at the end of the day, it's a very big release all the way down the stack. So I tend to focus on things like C# 4 and the enhancements coming in C# 4, the enhancements coming in Visual Basic, some basic F# work, as well as the CLR itself, which has a bunch of changes in it, not to even mention the BCL type improvements with the Managed Extensibility Framework, parallel extensions to the .NET Framework, all that kind of stuff. Some of them that are drastically different programming models than we have access to today in .NET 3.5 SP1.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, then let's start at the low-level stuff and work our way up. So this is an all-new CLR, and the .NET 4 CLR is side-by-side, so you can have this installed with your existing CLR, and it doesn't break anything.
Absolutely, and what I find exciting about what they've done with side-by-side in CLR 4 is that before with CLR 2, we were, of course, able to have out-of-process side-by-side, where both could be on the same machine, but there were some issues with auto-rolling forward and all that kind of stuff that we know about. But with CLR 4, we're also supporting in-process side-by-side. So within the same process, you can have both the CLR 4 and CLR 2 loaded at the same time. Let's say if you have a host application where the host needs to rev itself as well as it wants to rev itself. Let's say the host wants to be running on CLR 4, but in order to not break all its various add-ins and plugins, it wants the plugins to run in CLR 2. That's possible now with this new in-process side-by-side support in CLR 4.
Because I remember that this was a big problem when I was moving from 1.1 to 2.0, when I had existing plugins, not just ones that ran in Outlook, but also ones that ran in Windows Explorer. Because basically, whatever CLR got there first won.
Exactly.
And now your COM objects and your plugins, their choice of CLR is respected.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a big deal, especially when you consider, you know, how is Microsoft going to take its own properties like Windows and Office and such and fully embrace .NET? And it just was not possible without in-process side-by-side because of those issues, like you mentioned, with Explorer and everything, where it's fundamentally its own process and one process.
Mm-hmm. So I actually put a thing on my blog a couple of days ago about pushing this out via Windows Update, and I asked a bunch of people to try to basically put in a little opt-in registry key so that they might get .NET Framework over Windows Update. A couple of things that I noticed that were cool about .NET 4 was that it's really small. The client was like 28 megs or something like that.
Yeah, they've done a lot of work in that area.
Yeah, it was crazy small. And it installed much faster. It just seemed, I don't know. I mean, I don't work on that team, but it just seemed like it was lighter weight somehow, or you know, just generally that right. You're only bringing down the client. You're like, this means that if your mom wants to install like a .NET Twitter client, she's not going to go and get ASP.NET. So you're getting the .NET Framework, you know, client piece.
Right, which is all most people will ever need on their machine, anyways.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing that I think is important when it comes to installing the .NET Framework 4 is because we're not automatically rolling older applications. Let's say I have .NET Framework 3.5 installed and I have an application that's targeting 3.5. If I install .NET Framework 4, we won't automatically run those applications against 4. We'll go ahead and run them against 3.5, and you kind of have to opt in to say automatically roll me forward. So it helps with kind of the backwards compatibility issues that we've faced in the past with previous .NET Framework releases.
Okay, so that means, hang on, so that means that if I install .NET Framework, it's not going to promote my app without asking, or do I have to actually opt in?
You have to actually opt in and either recompile the app specifically for 4 or via configuration say, yes, I want you to automatically run me in the context of .NET Framework 4.
Okay, well, that's good. So then I could have basically, you know, I could even have, I suppose, CLR 1, 2, 3, and 4 all on the same machine, not CLR rather, but .NET Framework, and it'll all just work.
Yeah, and then what I like about that, looking back at previous jobs I've had, when you have 30, 40, who knows how many applications that you're in charge of, then you mm-hmm. can truly pick and choose one by one which ones you want to take forward to the new version of the framework.
Hmm, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think being able to have all that stuff in the same IIS instance can be really important. Because I know, I mean, like my last company, we still have 1.1 applications out there, and mm-hmm. a lot of people do. And you know, it's one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of a situation. Certainly, I don't want to have to install a new framework if I've got an existing app. But if I'm, you know, maybe extending that app in an easy way. But I've also heard that .NET 4, and I've experienced this with a couple of my apps, is pretty compatible in the sense that, like, you know, I know that we've got Dustblog running on version 4. You know, it's side by side, and it feels like it's dramatically different. But from a compatibility perspective, it doesn't seem to be breaking piles of stuff. But you were talking about low level. What kind of low level things have changed that I might want to watch out for?
Well, actually, not a lot of things. One that actually may potentially have an impact if you're using it heavily is one that, frankly, is a change that I'm really proud of that the team has mm-hmm. done that I think has potential impact, but we hope won't have huge impact, and that's mm-hmm. the changes in the CLR4 security model. Mm-hmm. So essentially, the way that I like to say this to people is code access security is dead.
Hmm. Okay.
And I'll kind of let that settle in, where, you know, this idea of a machine level policy that's very granular when it comes to what code can or can't do is mm-hmm. absolutely gone in .NET Framework 4. That's been obsoleted. And in fact, when you install .NET Framework 4, the machine level policy of code access security, or CAS, is disabled. It's just non-existent.
Okay. So now I begin to panic now. Talk me down.
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, the first thing to talk you down is that if you need code access security, there is a configuration option that you can set in your app.config to say, yes, I want you to use the legacy code access security option. So mm-hmm. that's first one if you're making heavy use of it. Now, the second thing is, by saying there's no code access security, we don't mean there's no security, period. What the CLR4, what the full desktop CLR has done is that it's adopted the Silverlight model of security, where we're talking okay. about this security transparent code, essentially, where there's the ability of, when you think of attributes like allow partially trusted callers and the relationship between untrusted and trusted code, rather than being merely a verification layer, that's the full-blown security layer now as well.
Okay.
So really, the model to implement security in your application becomes a heck of a lot easier than it was. If I have a host application that has a set of add-ins, when I spin up a separate app domain to host the add-ins, then I just make my host APIs say, these are the full trusted assemblies that I'm going to trust, and they're going to run at full trust. And then mm-hmm. if any of the add-ins actually try to reference my what's called critical code, then that fails. Transparent code cannot call into critical code. That's at runtime, if you try to do that by calling a method or something in a critical library, that will throw a runtime exception. That's a failure. It's not allowed. Well, in okay. the middle of transparent code and critical code, we have what's called safely critical code, which is this is the stuff that you expose saying, I have designed this specifically to be used and called from transparent callers. So this way I can essentially expose my host API, or a subset of my host API, that I'm saying my add-ins are designed to use these assemblies.
Okay.
So that way they still get all the functionality they want, but if some random add-in tries to call file.read or file.open on some system level or even on some random file, that will fail because that file API is considered critical code that transparent code isn't allowed to call into.
I see. So it's granular, but it's just not as intensely granular as it was before.
Right, exactly. And the problem before with code access security wasn't only the granular aspect of it. It was the fact that since you had something completely external to your application, being the machine config file, you could deploy your application if it was CAS aware.
CAS being code access security.
Right, yeah. Using code access security, you deployed your application to two different environments, and the applications could behave completely differently, all depending on that machine config. So I could have an IT pro or something that changes what the machine config is allowed to do on a machine, which might break my application. And so I would deploy my application there, it would break, and it would be kind of a confusing figuring out why it's broken when it's not broken on any other machine. So it became this huge, complex matrix where when you're developing an app at development time, if you were using code access security, you couldn't guarantee what the security context was going to be at runtime.
Hey, everybody, this is Scott coming at you from another place in time. No doubt you probably bump into testing tasks now and then in your work. And you know, writing functional tests is probably not your favorite thing. It's kind of difficult, takes time, and the results can be dubious. Well, get ready to start liking tests thanks to Telerik with the new WebEye testing framework. Building web automation tests is a breeze. You've got code automation with advanced ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight applications. You can write a single test, have it executed against multiple browsers at once. You benefit from a rich API. There's link support, integration with Visual Studio unit testing, also NUnit, XUnit, and MBUnit. Not to mention the free wrappers for Telerik RAD controls for ASP.NET Ajax and Silverlight, all shipping with Telerik's new testing tool. One of the best features, the WebEye testing framework, which is developed by Art of Test, is it's absolutely free. If you've already got hooked on WebEye testing framework, start using it right away. Go to Telerik.com for more info. Thanks a lot. All right, so talk to me about language level stuff. What's new, what's better in like C Sharp and VB?
So this is one where C Sharp and VB, both of them, the way I really talk about the improvements that are coming is this topic that you hear this all the time in like the Ruby world, is this ceremony versus essence. Now, it seems kind of ridiculous at first to talk about ceremony versus essence for a statically typed language. But I think it's very true in the case of, let's say, C-sharp 4. If we're going to dig into specific features of C-sharp 4, like the idea of named and optional parameters is one where now I can actually, when I call a method in my code, I can actually explicitly say this method, or excuse me, this parameter name, so parameter name colon, and then the value. And why I talk about that as a ceremony versus essence issue is the things that we had to do before merely to jump through the hoops of the compiler in order to express what we wanted in code. So the idea of optional values in method calls, frequently we would use method overloading, for example, where method overloading is a great language feature, but I think it's a language feature that's not meant to express optional values. It's really meant to express a method that's called with different contexts. You know, in the time that, you know, if you have, you know, in some case of the framework APIs, eight different method overloads strictly to express, you know, optional parameters where one method overload calls into another method overload, passing it an extra value and so on. I think it breaks down really quickly and it's a lot of ceremony that you have to jump through when the presence of optional parameters and being able to just say, you know, in the method declaration that this value, if it's not specified, default it to true. You know, that is much more concise with the essence of the code and what the developer is actually wanting to express. So we have named and optional parameters. And the other big one for C-sharp 4 that obviously has a lot of heat and debate going on about it is the dynamic keyword. And to me, the dynamic keyword, yes, it'll of course be abused. I mean, we see other language features abused as well. But the usefulness of the dynamic keyword, I think about it strictly from an interop scenario. When you're interoping with dynamic code, when you're interoping perhaps with XML, that's where the dynamic keyword really comes in handy. Because frankly, if you're gonna, if you have a scenario where you're trying to use it in a bunch of places, why not just use a dynamic language? So I think its real power is for working, like, interfacing with dynamic languages or interfacing, let's say, with COM, interfacing with XML. To me, the dynamic keyword is all in interop feature, really, at the core of it.
But would you consider it interop to talk C-sharp to, like, Python or Ruby? Is that interop, or is that just two different languages talking to each other?
No, I would absolutely consider that interop. Because we're talking about a static type system trying to communicate to a dynamic type system, which is kind of a fundamental shift that you're having to kind of bridge this rift that exists between the two. So I would definitely consider that an interop scenario, just like I would consider C-sharp to COM an interop scenario.
Okay. I always explain the dynamic keyword, because people always, I was actually presenting a couple of days ago, and someone said, well, you know, this is just like var. And I said, well, you know, var keyword is your way of saying, kind of, I'm too lazy to tell you what this is, but I'm pretty sure you'll figure it out.
Yes.
Actually, I'm 100% sure you'll figure it out. While the dynamic keyword is the, I really have absolutely no idea, and not only can I not figure it out, but you probably won't be able to figure out, you, the compiler, until runtime.
Yeah. Yeah, really, the dynamic keyword, all I think about it is essentially runtime dispatch. It's just runtime call dispatching where you're saying, you know, I want you to bind this as late as possible. Don't figure out until runtime what the heck you need to do, because that's where you'll have the information that's necessary.
What about VB? What's the love for VB? Because it's C-sharp 4, but it's VB10, I guess they're calling it.
Yeah, Visual Basic 10. So VB10 has actually several features that have come forward from previous versions of C-sharp. Like, you have auto-implemented properties, you have statement lambdas, you have multi-line lambdas, stuff that to us C-sharp developers seems pretty silly because we've had it all along, but were real sore points when writing code with Visual Basic 9, because especially as you're trying to work with a library that's perhaps lambda heavy or very, very heavy or very, very frequent use of lambdas, it became very painful because there were all sorts of hacks you'd have to do where you'd have to implement a temporary method or a temporary function, and then perhaps even return nothing if it was just a statement, which was very, very ugly. So that stuff is taken care of, and that's very powerful. And then the other one is auto-implemented properties is a big one, which of course we have in C#, but as a C# developer, why I'm jealous, frankly, of Visual Basic auto-implemented properties is that you can have your auto prop and then immediately say, you know, dim blah is property equals, and then the default value. Whereas in C#, like in the constructor or something else, then you would have to set the auto prop. But you can do it in line with Visual Basic. And then one of the other big ones, which gets a lot of applause when I'm talking to Visual Basic developers, is the removal or the introduction of implicit line continuation. So you don't have to have, for most cases, you don't have to have that silly underscore character at the end of a line to denote, hey, this continues on to the next line. Which
right,
becomes really important when you have multi-line lambdas.
I suppose that you can have that if you want to, which means that old-style code works fine, but you don't need it anymore.
Right.
Right. And that would certainly make multi-line lambdas a lot easier. Now,
yep.
Well, you wrote a demo a while back called Contoso Automotive, which was basically a... You always downplay it, Jason, but it's a cool WPF application that it talks about a theoretical car dealership, and it's got kind of this generated in-memory database of a couple of 100,000 cars, and it's got a plug-in model, and it uses parallel extensions. It uses PFX and some of the new stuff that makes multi-threaded and multi-core just so much easier. And I use this demo all the time. I think it's a great demo. Talk to me about what we did with parallel extensions in that, and why do I like that demo so much?
Cool. So first of all, shameless self-plug. I've gone ahead and revved Contoso Automotive because there were legal issues I had to do, like not using actual real car dealers and
really?
That kind of
wow.
stuff. Yeah, exactly. So I had to change that, made up, you know, use lorem ipsum to make up some make-believe car models and stuff. So, and that's packaged with our Visual Studio 2010 and .NET Framework 4 training kits that our team produces. And I'll make sure to get you a URL that you can include in the show notes to it.
Great.
What I love about the parallel extensions when it comes to using it as a way to build a responsive UI, like I did with the simple app of Contoso Automotive, is that fundamentally, in parallel extensions, the new primitive that you're dealing with is this task object, where you don't even have to worry about threads anymore. You really focus on tasks, which are very almost declarative in a way. Not declarative as we typically think it, but declarative in the sense that you're telling the library, this is what I want to get done. I don't care how it gets done. Just do it. I don't care if you do it on another thread. I don't care if you do it on the same thread. You figure that out for me. But I'm declaring this is a task that needs to be run. And why I use it in Contoso Automotive as opposed to like background worker or something else is that tasks not only are very powerful for chaining, so I can say, and I do say in Contoso Automotive, disable the search buttons when I actually execute a search. Disable the search buttons, then in a task, run this query to return the search results. And then I say dot continue with, and then enable search. So no matter whether that task fails or what, it'll automatically continue in order to enable re-enable the search. And so I have this way of almost building a hierarchy of tasks that need to be completed or that I'm going to run. And then on top of that, there's this cancellation token source is what we call it. Think of this as just a simple way of a flag that you can pass around that says, hey, when I signal this, when I turn on the light, when it goes off, then cancel anything that hasn't run yet. So in the case of parallel extensions, when I'm doing the parallel version of the search, for every car, for every type of car that it searches against, which is potentially 5 to 6 cars, then it'll actually allow me to cancel everything to where I just, on the token, I just say, cancel anything that's going on. And then the parallel extensions library will take care of, these 4 queries haven't run yet, so I'm just going to throw them out because they don't need to run. And it's a simple matter where if you look on the event handler for the cancel button, it's just essentially source.cancel. And I don't have to worry about anything else. Everything's automatic. All the search buttons are re-enabled. All the queries are canceled, taken care of for you by the library. It's very powerful.
Right. And the way that it's written is very kind of, it's very fluid. It's very fluent. It's like you're saying, was it task factory? Task factory.task.start? Something like that?
Yeah, it's task.factory.startnew. And then you pass it a lambda.
And then you say basically do this. So you're saying start this new task, and that happens in the background. And then you pass in the cancellation token, and it's kind of it's just this free object that is really, really smart about threading so that you can have your cancel button call that without having to worry about making that call.
Yep.
And then in the middle of your loop, you just check to see if that's gone bad, or does it just stop the thread automatically?
Yeah, the version that I have now will essentially check to say, hey, if a cancellation is requested, then go ahead and silently exit whatever you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's really cool is there's going to be some improvements where they're thinking about the point where it'll automatically, like, that's the sequential version. The sequential version that does a for each over the queries and does it will do is cancellation requested, just return. But the other one, if you look at it, doesn't do that. I do have a parallel dot for each, which is another very powerful construct, where I've passed in the search or I've passed in the cancellation token, and I just run my queries in that. And then if the cancellation token is fired, it'll automatically take care of, okay, I don't need to do the other iterations of the parallel dot for each and all that kind of stuff automatically for you.
I've heard them say that this is concurrency for the masses is like the tagline that people have
yeah,
said.
That's the long-term vision for the parallel computing platform team's work is they want to get where concurrency for the masses, where you don't have to have, your Einsteins or very smart people dedicated strictly to concurrency issues. You want the people in the trenches to be able to address concurrency and parallelism. It's certainly an improvement in Visual Studio 2010. It's not all the way yet. You still have to know a lot about potential dead blocks and performance optimizing your code and everything because you still can't hang yourself. But it's a drastic step in a really cool direction that they're going to continue to take.
I think that when you just said that you don't have to be like an Einstein, I don't think it's about being really, really smart. For me, it's about tediousness. There's been so many times when I've wanted to add something multi-threaded to an application where even something like, I'll just spin off a thread. And I said, you know, it's just not worth the hassle. This particular project or task or whatever I'm working on, it's just not worth the effort because I'm always concerned that I'm going to get the threading wrong. So I like that this is basically encapsulated best practices for kind of those basics. And I thought it was mostly just basics, but then Stephen Tobe, who works on the team, came out with this amazing white paper. It's like 113 pages or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Free download. On parallel programming patterns.
Yeah, parallel programming patterns. And I was like, oh, wow, this is so much deeper than I gave it credit for. He talks at the beginning about what he called, I think it was embarrassingly parallel, but then he called it delightfully parallel.
Yeah, these are, exactly.
Yeah. These are algorithms and problems that really lend themselves to parallelism. Delightfully parallel in the sense of there's really no reason that this can't be on multiple threads and on multiple cores. And mm-hmm. then as you move forward in the, in this chapter of this mini book that he's written, then you start getting into some really hardcore, interesting problems that are much more complicated. So this is not just for throw off something in a background thread, but you can
right,
do
exactly.
some intense computing with this thing.
Mm-hmm. Very intense. And it's a very capable library that, frankly, the Contoso Automotive example just shows, you know, how to do it simple in the context of, you know, a responsive UI. But it's absolutely so much more than that. It's not even funny.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So I hear, and forgive me if I'm telling tales or anything, but you're moving into a different role. You've been in DPE for
yeah.
a while. Is that okay to talk about?
Yeah, it is. I've been in DPE now, wow, it's hard to believe, 3.5 years. I originally started on Windows Server 2008 and then migrated over to Visual Studio 2010 and .NET Framework 4. And have moved on now onto a product team actually shipping code. So I'm going to be leaving DPE, and as of, well, by the time this airs, it'll probably be already the case. But okay. I'll be working as a PM in Windows focused on the developer experience.
So you're going to be responsible, PMing, you're going to be program manager of a feature on Windows.
Yes, exactly. Or multiple features on Windows. We'll wait and see how that goes. Pretty exciting.
Cool.
I can't believe that a future version of Windows is going to ship and I'll be able to open something up on Windows and be like, see that? Yeah, I helped that.
That's cool. Be like, say, yeah, you see that calculator? That was all me.
I know, yeah. See that new Notepad? Yeah, that was me. See that button in Notepad?
You totally
yeah.
rocked Notepad, Jason.
Right, exactly. That's my goal in life, is to rock Notepad.
Very cool. Well, congratulations. That's awesome.
Ah, thanks a bunch. I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on the show and talking to me about some of the low-level stuff. And we'll get, like you said, you send me the links, and I'll put them on the show site for CLR4, C#4, VB10, and some of the parallel extensions.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's been a pleasure, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.